WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, A Scanner Darkly, is a story about addiction, paranoia, betrayal, government surveillance, and corporate greed. Reviewing it in the New York Times, Manola Dargis wrote, "It's a look at a future that looks an awful lot like today." The movie is based on the 1977 novel of the same name by the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. My guest Richard Linkletter wrote and directed the film adaptation. He also made the movies Slacker, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, and Before Sunrise. A Scanner Darkly is set 17 years into the future in Southern California. Most of the characters in the film are addicted to pills called Substance D. The government is cracking down on the problem by going after users and encouraging citizens to report friends and neighbors who they suspect of using. Keanu Reeves plays an undercover narcotics agent who's addicted to Substance D. His friends are played by Robert Downey Jr., Woody Harrelson, Winona Ryder, and Rory Cochrane. But the film is animated with a computer process that kind of paints over the images of the real actors. Here's a scene from the film. The friends played by Rory Cochrane and Robert Downey Jr. are sitting in a diner. Cochrane is a paranoid mess from Substance D and has had hallucinations that his hair and body are infested with bugs. He's asked Downey to help him out. Cochrane speaks first.
I heard you have to go cold turkey.
Cold turkey doesn't even apply to Substance D. Unlike the legacy of inherited predisposition to addictive behavior or substances, this needs no genetic assistance. There's no weekend warriors on the D. You're either on it, or you haven't tried it.
Well, I like it.
Yeah. How many caps do you take per day?
It's very difficult to determine, but not that many.
Well, like the old school pharmacopoeia, tolerance develops. You know, these visions of bugs, they're just garden variety psychosis, but a clear indication that you've hurtled over the initial fun and euphoric phase and passed on to the next phase. News from the guinea pig grapevine suggests that whatever it is, we won't know until it's way too late. You see, we're all canaries in the coal mine on this one.
Richard Linkletter, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the drug of the movie, which is called Substance D?
You know, it's pretty vague in the book what Substance D is, and it was something that with the cast we talked about. Well, what would the properties of it be? What is it? Is it an opiate? Is it a, you know, stimulant? We never really defined it, and I think it's purposefully vague. But if you think about it, it's a designer drug, but it's really for kind of designed as a consumer product. But it's kind of the worst of all worlds. It's a consumer product, and it's really bad for you. It's highly addictive, and it ultimately, this is where the paranoia comes in. It's used for control. You lose yourself, and then ultimately you're kind of available as slave labor. It takes away the individual, but leaves the laborer. So it's your absolute most paranoid nightmare of your situation and how you're being used in a way beyond your darkest imagination. But I think that's valid thinking when you think of drugs in general. One of my heroes of all time was Frank Zappa, who was a big anti-drug guy. That resonated with me as a teenager. That's why I've never been a drug guy, because I took that to heart. You know, he's like, well, when you do drugs, there's a guy in an office wringing his hands saying, you know, profiteering off you, and you've removed yourself as a threat from the political spectrum. If you're just off using alone in your own world, you're not really challenging the status quo or the powers that be in any way. You know, it's a statement perhaps, but from a dropout perspective.
Yeah. You're using the same animation system in A Scanner Darkly that you used in Waking Life, and it's an animation that's built on real live actors. I'm going to ask you to describe what this type of animation is.
Yeah, I mean, there's not really a succinct name for it. It's a computer variation from of rotoscoping, kind of an old technique where you the animators draw over existing imagery. In our case, we make the movie like any movie. You cast, rehearse, shoot, edit, all that live action like a regular movie, lock picture, and then you start the lengthy animation process, which is, in my case here, about 50-plus animators sitting down on home computers and spending over about 500 hours to produce 1 minute of the animation. Very painstaking, but a very artistic process. I mean, these are really talented drawers and painters and artists, so it's like doing the movie twice, really.
Is there anything you did different directing the actors for A Scanner Darkly, knowing that it was ultimately going to be an animation?
You know, I think every actor on the movie would probably have a different response to that. I mean, Keanu and Winona would say no. You know, they're very realistic, if anything, even more realistic. But that's their characters. I think Rory Cochrane, Woody Harrelson, Robert Downey Jr. might say it freed them up, or I pushed them a little more. Their performances are a little bigger. I think that's their characters, and that's the story. I think live action, it might have seemed a little too big, maybe, but the animation, I think, kind of forgives it in a way, and you just accept them as a character. You know, they're having these, you know, thought bubbles and seeing things and hallucinations, and I think they felt free to kind of push it a little bit.
Your movie adaptation of A Scanner Darkly ends with a quote from the Philip K. Dick book. And I want to read that quote. It says, "This has been a story about some people who were punished entirely too much for what they did. I loved them all. Here is a list to whom I dedicate my love." And after each name on the list is an explanation of what happened to the person: deceased, permanent psychosis, permanent brain damage, permanent vascular damage, permanent pancreatic damage. He writes, "In memoriam, these were comrades who I had. There are no better. They remain in my mind. The enemy will never be forgiven. The enemy was their mistake in playing. Let them play again in some other way, and let them be happy." Do you feel like you have a similar list of friends who you lost to drugs?
I think everyone working on the movie, and I think everyone in life past a certain age, you do have a list of friends who, if not drugs, it's alcohol, it's other self-destructive, maybe elements they brought into their life. And, yeah, you lose people along the way. So I think everyone working on the film, we were all working off our own lists. And we didn't even talk about it that much. It was just sort of there. But, you know, we're paying, you know, respects to Philip K. Dick's list because that's, you know, it's his story. But I think in a personal way, the way we're all aboard this project, we all felt, you know, we had those people. And it's a sad fact that some of the brightest, most intelligent, gifted people do kind of burn out and self-destruct young, you know, much earlier than their time. You know, it's you know, one of the tragedies of life. And Philip K. Dick himself died much too young. He was only 53. Which, when I was 22, you know, when I heard he died, I was like, well, that's, you know, he lived, that's a long time. You know, as you get closer to that, you start thinking, wow, that was really young. There's 20, 30, yeah. 30 more years of books he could have written. The tragedy, and then you meet his daughters, and you realize, oh, they have kids now that never got to meet their grandfather. The human toll there is enormous.
Was his death related to drugs?
Well, brought on. He died of a, you know, stroke, heart attack, you know, these kind of things brought on by, you know, a long period of amphetamine use. So, yes, I mean, when I first met his daughters to get the rights to do this novel, they were very protective of it because it was so personal to their dad, and they were very concerned about the tone I was going to take, in particular in relation to the drug use. I mean, Issa, his youngest daughter, told me, you know, just so you know, she pointed to the list, you know, that's my dad, because Philip K. Dick put himself on the list. And then she pointed down the list a little more and said, you know, that's my mom. You know, I lived in that house. We moved out, and then those guys moved in. So, and if it wasn't for drugs, you know, our father would still be writing. So they just wanted to know what my take was on the drug element.
While you were making A Scanner Darkly, or more specifically, while the animators were finishing up the animation part of A Scanner Darkly, you were also making the movie Fast Food Nation, which is opening in the early fall, I think.
October, yes.
Yeah, and so that's an adaptation of the Eric Schlosser bestseller about the fast food industry's impact on human and animal health. You're making a fictionalized version of that book. What gave you the idea of taking, you know, a nonfiction investigative repertorial book and fictionalizing it with a story?
Well, I mean, I was a big fan of the book. That's an industry, and that's an area I'm really interested in, both the labor part and the animal rights element, the health aspect. It's kind of a fascinating area. But I met with Eric, and we started talking about it as a movie, and it was really his idea, actually, to kind of throw out the book and make a character piece about the workers behind the fast food meal from various angles. The undocumented workers coming in from Mexico, an executive at the fast food chain, a teenage girl who works the counter at the fast food place, and just kind of get into their lives and see the story from multi viewpoints.
My guest is Richard Linklater. He directed the new film, A Scanner Darkly. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Linklater. He wrote and directed the new film adaptation of the Philip K. Dick novel, A Scanner Darkly. Some of your movies have a way of connecting to the zeitgeist. I'm thinking of Slacker and, you know, Dazed and Confused, which I think really touched on a lot of people's shared high school memories. School of Rock, it just captured a whole kind of spirit and type of person. Is it something you try for? Do you consciously think of yourself of trying to connect to the cultural moment?
No, I swear. I mean, quite the opposite. I mean, I never, when I approach a film, film isn't a good medium to actually do that. I think music's probably it's a much more spontaneous, quicker response time. Movies take years, and I think you would probably risk not quite catching it, or you can't really predict. You know, I've always had my eye on a much longer term kind of storytelling prize of just trying to tell stories and characters that are very personal to me, that just resonate with me. And sometimes, you know, it comes out at a time that people will find it seems meaningful for the moment. And then a lot of movies, something you feel equally close to, it'll come out and people will just kind of shrug their shoulders. So you can't really think about that.
What was your personal connection to the character in School of Rock, who was played by Jack Black? And he's somebody who appears to be a real loser. He's not a very good performer. The rock band he's in throws him out. And then he becomes a substitute teacher and ends up becoming this fantastic teacher of music, rock music, to these kids in the class. He forms this incredible band. What did you relate to about that?
Well, I think I spent my 20s as a person who was very passionate about something, but I had nothing to show for it. And I know what it's like to be kind of considered a loser or considered a non-productive member of our society, because you're not making much money yourself, if any, and you're certainly not making anyone else any money. So you're sort of scorned, looked down upon. But I feel like there's so many people out there who, when they do find their niche and can bring their passion to something, they can actually be very helpful to people around them and themselves ultimately. It's just kind of putting yourself out there and finding your niche in this world. And in a humorous way, Jack Black, in that movie, his character Dewey Finn, just sort of he falls into it. And I thought that was a fun little message to kind of work with within that story. But my passion was really just for the music and Jack's character. For me, that was me for a large part of my 20s. And while I wasn't a striving musician, I was like a film guy. You know, I had a film society, I watched movies, I cared about movies, and that was my whole life.
How did you first get to watch movies that weren't the movies playing in the multiplexes?
Well, for me, it was curiosity. I'd been to a couple years of college, and, you know, every college professor is kind of a, every English professor is a, you know, film critic. So we started, this is in the early days of, you know, VCRs. We'd watch a film at night, you know, once a week in the English department that I was studying. And, you know, it'd be Clockwork Orange or 2001 or, you know, something. And we'd talk about it, and it got me thinking about films in that way. At that point, I think I was an aspiring writer, maybe playwright. I was writing some plays, but I hadn't really thought seriously about cinema. You know, I grew up in East Texas, and it wasn't a career option, especially back then. I don't think people even knew what a director did. You know, for me, films are just something that came to our town. We watched them, and they went away, you know. But once I started thinking about it seriously, I just started seeking out alternatives in the history of cinema, and I found myself, I was an offshore oil worker for a few years. I was living in Houston, but they still had repertory theaters. And when I wasn't on the rigs, I was in a movie. I just found myself in a movie theater watching three, sometimes four movies a day. I'd go home and read about the talent involved in the movie, you know, the writers, the director, the producer, whoever, you know, actors. I was just educating myself. I bought some books on the technical aspects of filmmaking, and I just found myself being totally taken over by cinema. I realized I had films in my head. So I was just doing a segue from my earlier ambitions into realizing cinema was probably the medium. It was kind of discovering, I was discovering it. So it was a wonderful, wonderful period in my life. I just saw tons of movies and educated myself. And thought about getting in film school, but I never did.
You know, it's funny. Like you found a way when you were younger to catch up on a lot of, you know, like foreign films and film, you know, classic films of the past and so on. And you've become one of the more influential independent filmmakers. The film that you remade, you know, was The Bad News Bears. And I have to say, I never saw the original, but I enjoyed your version of it, and it's a really fun Billy Bob Thornton performance. But what in the world made you want to remake that?
I know, it seems like an odd choice, doesn't it? But I don't know. I attended college on a baseball scholarship. I spent a lot of my life involved in baseball. As a younger person, I relate to those characters. And as an older person, I relate to Billy Bob's character, the kind of failed baseball player who only went so far. And I could feel that as sort of a parallel life to my own. So there was a very much a personal end to that story, the same way there would be maybe with School of Rock, say Jack Black's character and those kids. And I don't know, it's just one of those things that gets over, you know, gets into you. And it was very funny what that film was striving to be. It's much kind of edgier and nastier than School of Rock. And I like that kind of part of it, that that's another side of childhood where kids are cursing other kids and being mean to them. And I had a lot of fun. It ultimately, to me, it felt like a pretty subversive film to come out of a studio system. Like, that movie couldn't have been made today if that was an original concept. It'd be like, oh, you know, the behavior's so bad, you know, but because it had this successful precedent, and the film was a hit back in 76, that we sort of were given carte blanche to make that movie. So we got away with a lot of really kind of screwed up behavior and really messed up, you know, bad attitudes. So that's my kind of studio film, something I can embrace.
Do you have any idea when you first realized that there was such a thing as a film director? That it wasn't just like stories and actors on a screen, that there was actually a job called director, and it might be a job you'd be interested in doing.
Gosh, I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say I didn't really know. I was probably almost college age. I mean, which is unfathomable now, but, you know, 25 years ago, it wasn't a part of the culture. I knew who Alfred Hitchcock was just because he was that kind of big guy who he had something to do with those scary movies. I thought maybe he wrote them or I didn't know. You know, growing up, he was like the famous guy. And then, you know, I didn't know who, you know, Orson Welles was a guy on commercials who sold wine or something. I had no idea who he was. I was kind of oblivious to it. Again, it was a cultural thing where I grew up and in the culture at the time, people didn't really talk about it that much. But, I mean, it's become very different now. Everybody's behind the scenes. Everybody knows, you know, who does it and how you do it and what's going on there. But I think Martin Scorsese was one of the first ones I really, like, went out of my way, like, oh, I saw Raging Bull, and I was like, wow, geez, you know, film can do that. And then I, like, looked it up. Oh, there's this movie, Taxi Driver, I need to see. So I, you know, was playing at this repertory theater. I went and saw that, and I started kind of like, oh, wow, you know, what an artist. You know, I discovered him. But at the same time, I was discovering, you know, world cinema and the French New Wave and the new German cinema. And, you know, it was just all hit me at once. But I came to it really late, but I certainly caught up pretty quick. But I'm kind of glad it wasn't an ambition of mine growing up. I think if you're 9 years old now, I meet nine-year-olds who want to be film directors. I'm like, hey, you know, that's great. It's probably not a lot different than wanting to be a pro ball player, though. You know, so the odds of you actually getting to do this at this level are probably even less. But not a bad ambition to have, but kind of a hard skill set to define that I'm still trying to figure out. But I feel myself very lucky to whatever combination it is to be able to, you know, be here and get to keep doing it. You know, I feel lucky.
Well, Richard Linklater, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, really nice talking to you. Thanks, Terry.
Richard Linklater wrote and directed the new film adaptation of Philip K. Dick's novel, A Scanner Darkly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.